Okay, so what we've been doing is we've been exploring five stages of spiritual life. And I was explaining, and he said last week, that in terms of stages, hierarchically, you can think of them as starting with, well, you start with a stage of integration, becoming a whole person, so that you can make real choices based on your own genuinely healthy self-will. And then the second stage is a stage of positive emotion, or Sankusala Karma, which means skillful action, helpful action, beneficial action, which is a stage of ethics, really. And I'll try and say more about that today. Then you have the stage of spiritual death, where you realize that you've been using yourself to go beyond yourself. You've been refining yourself in the stage of positive emotion and integration. You've been trying to become a more positive and beneficial presence in the world to yourself and to other people. But there's always a residue of self in that, however much, however developed it is. And at some point that self has to die. So there's a stage of spiritual death. And you can't do that unless you've got enough integration and enough positive emotion, because you'll read it negatively. Yes, but there's a stage of spiritual death. After the stage of spiritual death, out of that death comes spiritual rebirth. You have some wholly new motivation sort of dawns in you. There you go. A wholly new motivation, as it were, from outside of you, dawns on you, dawns within you. And then the last stage is the stage of spontaneous compassionate activity, or no more effort, no more learning, where you just enjoy the fruits of the new volitional force that's running through you. You don't need to make any effort anymore. Or probably it's better to think you don't need to make an effort to make an effort. You just naturally do it. It's a bit like someone practicing an instrument. There's a point to which their interest and passion really pours into the instrument, and they don't need to make themselves practice anymore. They just sort of want to, So I'd imagine the stage of no more effort is like that. You don't need to get yourself to do it anymore. You just want to do it, so you don't need to make an effort quite. There may be effort involved, but you don't need to make one. And then I was saying last week that, so you can think of them as stages like that, starting with where we are now and cultivating integration, all the way through positive emotion, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, and compassionate activity, spontaneous compassionate activity. Or you can think of them as aspects of a spiritual life, literally an aspect of a day that we're trying to cultivate. So there needs to be an aspect of integration, an aspect of positive emotion, an aspect of receptivity, and because that's, and in this, if you arrange them horizontally, no more effort becomes receptivity, an aspect of spiritual death, and an aspect of spiritual rebirth. So I want to carry on exploring those. Yesterday, whatever it was, we were exploring integration. I want to say a bit more about that, and a bit more about positive emotion. Let's see if we can get a bit more into spiritual death. So yesterday at Dharma Jaya I was saying, yes, but why start with body awareness? So I was saying that the epitome is a practice of the stage of awareness, of integration, was a mindfulness of breathing and mindfulness of the body generally. So the main thing we do to try and cultivate integration is keep coming back to our body, keep coming to our primary experience of the body, our senses, our sight, our sounds, our touch, our senses of the body, our direct senses. And we, that's where spiritual life begins, embodied life, coming back to our creaturely life. one of the reasons that we do that is because if we don't do that, our consciousness, as we develop it, will be developed in a distorted way. It'll be developed sort of out of nowhere. It'll be developed out of our ideas rather than our direct experience, is meaning. And our spiritual progress won't take place in a balanced way. So if we don't cultivate mindfulness of the body, if we don't start there, we can start from an idea, even including an idea about ourselves, an idea about who we are and what we want to do, but that's going to be almost by definition going to be distorted, and you'll end up spiritually developing in an unbalanced way. I think probably most of us do this to some degree, and you have to go back and collect bits of yourself that you sort of left behind. So that's one reason why we start the mindfulness of the body, is that so that as you develop, as you then go on to helpful action or skillful action, you do that thoroughly based in your direct experience rather than ideas about yourself, including bright ideas and spiritual ideas. Yes, so I thought that was quite a useful take on that, so that you start with your very direct real experience rather than an idea, rather than that, than a sort of vision even, although vision is included. And I think this stage of integration also includes sort of a rather cliche way of putting it, but getting to know yourself. Getting to know the kind of creature you are. I think actually this is very important as a stage. Finding out kind of who you are. I know you're not in an ultimate sense, but what your basic character type is. You may or may not want to get involved in what they call the character types, what they call Myers-Briggs. But you need to get start to know more and more clearly the kind of creature you are. And you need to know that so that you don't, so that your ethical choices, that you're going to come in to make in the second stage, are based on who you actually are, the kind of being you are. So you are an extrovert or an introvert? How do you work best? I found with myself, it's like we're a very sophisticated piece of machinery, as it were, a clumsy metaphor, but we need to find out what that piece of machinery is and how it works best. So for me, for instance, I'm quite extroverted, but I also need quite a bit of introvert at times, especially time on my own, and I also need time do things like writing, creative writing and so forth, some kind of artistic thing. If I don't, I go a bit wonky. If I spend too much of my time doing what I'm doing now or talking to people, I can't sustain it. So we need to start to get to know the kind of creature we are and how we work best, under what conditions we work best. That needs to include our relationship with other people. It's not trying to be indulgent about that. So, for instance, if I spend too much time writing poems and all those sort of things, I sort of get this horrible kind of feeling that I'm just sort of wasting my time. So a very uncomfortable sense of indulgence. And I need to make sure that I'm also spending time with friends, doing things to help others and so on. If I'm not doing that enough, my so-called creative life becomes too pressured. Too much weighted on it. I remember reading Ted Hughes' poems about him and Sylvia Plath. And by the time you get, they're called birthday letters, by the time you get halfway through them, you lose sympathy with both of them, at least I did. And you just want to get a job. You know, you think it's stop going on about, you know, bats and flowers and, you know, calm down. You want to throw a blanket over both of them. You slightly feel that they spent too long fiddling about with words, excuse me, you know, digging a trench wouldn't have been a bad idea. I noticed that. So I noticed, you know, that if I spend too long writing, it all gets a bit not very healthy, and then I need to go out and make sure that I'm also giving and acting in a practical and living way rather than a very introspective, intuitive way. It gets a bit too much. So this stage of integration is also just getting to know what sort of person you are and how you work best, and trying to make it so that you've got that as much as possible. You can't always do that, but you try to fashion your life in a way that helps you, your particularity, work best, because you'll have a very particular character. I think it's very important to get to know your cultural roots, as it were, so that you take into account the kind of cultural person you are. So I'm very, very English in terms of, in fact, I've become more and more English as I've gone on. Eventually I start having high tea at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm quite shy. I'm quite shy. I find expressing direct emotion rather embarrassing. I need to get to know all that, and sort of take that into account. I can't be somebody else, and you can't be someone else. And all that is ethically neutral. You just need to find out who you are, the cultural basis in which you come from, the kind of strengths and weaknesses you have naturally. As I said yesterday, they think that half of our characteristics are genetic. They even think things like pessimism are genetically loaded. So you know, if your parents are pessimists, you're more likely to be pessimistic yourself. You can change that, but you'll need to work to change that. Some people are just sort of naturally optimistic; they don't need to. If you are a bit like me, which I think I am a bit pessimistical, I need to actually consciously challenge some of those things, where some of my friends are just very naturally optimistic. Getting to know the kind of creature you are. In positive psychology, an American psychologist called Martin somebody.
Seligman.
Seligman, that's right, thank you. Martin Seligman. He talks about your strengths and virtues, doesn't he? And he talks about key strengths and virtues, signature strengths and virtues. So there's this whole test you can do where you find out what your key strengths and virtues are. So in his sort of understanding of psychology, he's saying what you need to do is find out what your signature strengths are, and you need to try to arrange your life so it meets those strengths as much as possible, and doesn't sort of press too hard on your weaknesses. He's not foolish about it. He's saying, look, of course you'll need to do other things, but see whether you can arrange it so that your key strengths are being met. Because if your key strengths are being met, they get sort of developed. His whole philosophy is that you need to develop your strengths and virtues and worry much less about your shortcomings. So, for instance, one of my key strengths, I like learning things, and I like teaching. So I enjoy teaching, and I often get good feedback from that, and it sort of increases that key strength. I can chair a business meeting, but it's much less a strength of mine. I can do it, but if I do a lot of it, I get very, very tired and then start to get a bit negative. Recently, at the Buddhist Centre in London, I ended up doing a lot of administration work, an awful lot of it, and it really didn't suit me. And I had to sort of step away from it. So I think it's an interesting thought. Anyway, get to know what your key strengths and virtues are, and try and organise your life as much as possible to meet them. So yes, I think the stage of integration includes being aware of your cultural background, being aware of the kind of person you are, your kind of mental physique, what shape you are mentally, as well as physically, what works for you, what doesn't work for you, without being terribly precious about that. For instance, some people are very physical type and they need to do a lot of exercise, and if they don't, it's not very good for them. A good friend of mine is very, very intelligent, and I think he needs to study a lot. He needs quite a lot of high-level input to use his mind, otherwise his intelligence becomes quite destructive. That's what can happen with intelligence. If you're not careful, you get quite destructive, and you need quite high-level input to be intelligent with. So yes, that's all of that, I think, part of integration. It's sort of self-knowledge, learning from your experience about yourself when you get stressed, when you get bad-tempered, when you feel really fulfilled, learning what that's saying about yourself. I was just talking to Carol just yesterday, and she was saying, I was saying, how are you getting on working in the centre? And she said, oh, I really love it, I just found my calling. And it's very, very evident that that's true. So not only does every time me and Carol see a very, very positive state of mind, it's just had an obviously very beneficial effect on the centre. That her calling of working here has meant it's done her good and it's done the situation good. So you get this kind of interaction between your key strengths and virtues and the world, and they feed each other. So all of that, I think, we could think of in terms of integration. How do you work best? What do you need? You know, like for instance, I need quite a lot of good quality communication. I'm not very good socially. I don't like social situations at all. In fact, I seem to like them less and less. But I do need very honest and meaningful communication. I need quite a lot of that. Otherwise, I start to feel a bit isolated. So just, that's an interesting way of starting to think about it. So all of that is so that you get to know who you are. You know the kind of physique you've got, the character type you are. You know what you'll be needing a bit. And then you can make ethical choices. Self-conscious, ethical choices, based in self-awareness. Just what I mean. Based in a real knowledge of the kind of person you are, not the kind of person you wished you were or thought you should be, not even the kind of person you think you are, because sometimes that's wrong as well. I had a friend of mine who was convinced he was a writer. The slight hitch was he'd never written anything. So, you know, you can think of something which you just simply aren't. Find out who you are, get feedback from your friends who you are. And that means that needs to be discovered and consciously discovered. You don't get, when you're born, you're not given a map of who you are, and you have to find out who you are by bumping into things, and very often bumping into other people. But all of that, based on body awareness, and often it's your body that will tell you things. How you are, who you are, what you need. Bhante himself, Sankaracharya himself, is very, very good at this. He knows exactly what he needs. He does an awful lot and always has all the way through his life. But he's quite capable of not doing what people want. So in some letters where he went to New Zealand, he went all the way over to New Zealand. And people were very, you know, it's the first time he visited, I think, and they all wanted to meet him. And he insisted on having the mornings to himself. Meet anybody. And people were eventually complaining about that. You know, they sort of felt that he should be on tap all the time. He just said, well, I need time on my own. You know, I need time on my own. And I was very struck by that, because I would have bowed to pressure, and also I like to be popular. So, you know, I would rather be popular and be a bit pressured. He sort of knows, and I want to continue practicing all the time, so I need to do that in a way that I can sustain all the time. And another time he goes on this retreat, he's been seeing all these people. He said he'd been seeing, you know, a few hundreds of people. And he goes on this retreat, and he says for the first 3 days of this retreat, he did absolutely nothing. I mean, nothing at all. He just sat in his room and looked out the window for 3 days. And I think he ate and went to the toilet. And luckily other people were there to lead the retreat. But I was quite struck by that he knows, he even someone has developed that he knows what he needs. He's very introverted, actually, in Sankaracharya, and knows that he needs that sort of time. And he's actually quite reluctant to give up, unless he really has to. So all of that is so that you can make ethical choices. Ethical choices based in real awareness of who you are, not ideas about who you are. Because the second stage of spiritual life is positive emotion or kusala karma or helpful action. It's to do the consciously willed action. So you're trying to consciously do more of the good and less of harm. And you try to do that on the basis of real self-awareness. That's what the second great stage of spiritual life, or the aspect of spiritual life, is. You're trying to do as much good as possible and as little harm as possible. And really the main thing is as much good as possible. Sometimes people get too preoccupied with doing less harm and they're not making enough of a contribution. In a way, the primary Buddhist virtue is generosity. You just need to give. Actually, just for your own well-being, you need to give. Apparently, if you give something, it sets off, it stimulates the same part of the brain as if you buy something for yourself. It has exactly the same kind of effect. So you need to just give for your own well-being. Sometimes that's all you need to do to get yourself into a better state of mind, is to give something. I think things are quite good to give. There should be constant exchange of things being given, just for the sake of it. I bought a friend some jam today. Also made. So yeah, just sort of giving. But giving, you know, based in the knowledge of yourself. So I've known people who need to just give themselves all the time. And they just get terrible, they get kind of exhausted and they run themselves a bit dry. So this kusala karma, skillful action, is to do with consciously acting for the benefit of all, including yourself, and consciously not acting on the benefit for people's harm. I was interestingly being a bit aside, but I've also been struck. We've seen some seminars recently how Bhante reminded us that in Buddhism, ethics is often translated as ethics and manners. And I was thinking about this thing of manners. I think it is in itself something of real value. It's difficult to talk about in the Western context because Western manners have got all kind of caught up with class and it's all got a bit self-conscious and a bit stiff. But I think of my good friend Jnana Varcher, who is the chair of the London Buddhist Centre, who was born in Africa. He's a Gujarati. He comes from a Gujarati family, and I think he's a really good example of manners. He's a good example of Oxford. He's a very good example of manners. He's always very, very polite, very friendly, very outgoing, very welcoming. And it has a really good effect. He's got many, many strengths, but it means that the strengths that he has got can sort of shine through because he's got such good manners. And what manners are basically to do with not putting other people at inconvenience, trying to please other people in a genuine sense, but in a kind of people-pleasing sense. Trying to please people, like your cake pleased me, and others, I could tell. In a way, it's a small thing, isn't it? But it immediately creates a lovely atmosphere, doesn't it? Oh, here's an atmosphere of people bring a cake. You know what I mean? It's a sort of, it says something, doesn't it, about the whole world that you're in. Nobody brings a cake when you go to the library or the cinema. You get friends in Oxford, you have in the cinema. Not vegan. on the tube, you know, get thrown off. So it tells you something immediately about the sort of place that you're in. Actually, it's an aspect of manner. So perhaps we should also think of this stage of kusala karma as manners. Not in the sense of sort of rather stiff, formal manners, but just sort of not inconveniencing people, not being rude to people, being good natured to people, making sure they're comfortable, all that sort of thing. Can make an awful lot of difference. People really need to feel that you're aware of them, and manners is one of the ways in which we communicate that we're aware of someone. Well, yourself, you say, would you like a cup of tea? It's like that, simple as that. You're aware of somebody, oh, I've just got a cup of tea, they might want some. They're very simple things, but they, in a way, they're very fully of the nature of ethics, aren't they? in a way, if there was just more of that, never mind anything more highfalutin than that, that would create quite a different world, wouldn't it? If more people brought cake and offered tea, in the great English tradition, in a way, it would make a better world. So yes, it's this whole area of beneficial activity placed in self-awareness. And what that does is, the more you practice ethics, the more your sense of yourself, the more your consciousness is lightened. I think of the whole of this second great stage of spiritual practice, or this aspect of spiritual practice, is making self light. When I'm in a genuinely positive state of mind, when I'm generous, when I'm thoughtful of others, when I'm giving, when I'm trying to help, when I'm being bothered enough to actually listen to somebody, what they're saying, and try to understand it, when I'm trying to tell the truth, when I'm being a bit courageous, it feels like myself is still there, but it's not centre stage anymore. It's not the main player. I've become more interested in life than just me. This is me. There's just so much to be involved in. Other people, the natural world, and so on. So this day, it's a sort of making self light. Every time we get into negative states of mind, self gets heavier and heavier, doesn't it? When we're in a bad state of mind, we constantly say I to ourselves. I this, I'm not like that, I'm just, they're like that, I'm like, you know. We become more and more self-preoccupied in a negative state of mind. In a way, that's what a negative state of mind is. It's a state of mind preoccupied with itself. Interestingly, it's one of the main symptoms of depression, is you get very self-preoccupied. And I know that because I've experienced it. You get very, self becomes more of a problem, more painful, and yet you're more and more preoccupied with that painful problem in yourself. The stage of positive emotion is about then consciously making wise choices about how to act, based on self-knowledge. So I need to be giving, I need to be in good communication. It particularly includes things like friendship, from a Buddhist point of view, the cultivation of a genuine friendship. Buddhism sees friendship as probably one of the most important kind of relationships. In a way, there's something about atmosphere at the centre, isn't there? There's an atmosphere of friendship, friendliness. So that's important. It's not that we all just come in and look at the teacher on a dyad and then all run off. Actually, do with us facing each other, not just facing the Buddha or facing the teacher, but facing each other. So friendship is an essential part of the second stage. And without friendship, people don't flourish. They don't flourish. They wither on the bough. They just don't flourish. And so again, there's a temper. You know, this is again why it's important to get to know yourself, because some people need quite a few friends. Some people, just one or two very good friends, really is all they need, and they don't need much more than that. And actually trying to make more friends is actually counterproductive, and spreads them too thin. Some people need to meet their friends a lot, some people don't need to meet their friends so much. I've got a friend of mine who's living in the community, and he said to me, I'm not going to ask to see you very much. I said, no, I thought not. Partly is he doesn't need to. Actually, partly is he doesn't want to as well. I know it's hard to believe. It's also because he's frightened of emotions. Now, of course, any closer relationship evokes emotion. But that's why you need to get to know yourself. Is it that? Or is it that actually, you need a lot of time on your own, and you know, you don't need too much interaction, and that doesn't help. And one needs to really be trying to understand that. It's not as easy as it sounds, either. Also, it includes friendship, it includes all of those ethical actions of generosity, of honesty, of contentment, all those things that we're trying to train in. I think it also includes participation in the arts, if possible. Now, I say this with some trepidation because I'm a rather arty person, and again, not everybody is. I was sharing a room until recently with somebody who's into surfing. and we were like this sort of contrast and compare. He literally turned up into the community with three surfboards. And I have about 300 poetry books in between. I wear glasses, he doesn't. He's 29 and I'm 15. Very odd meeting. He's very Australian. He actually slept with a map of Australia above his head. And he literally do. But you know, I think we've taken cultural conditioning a bit too far. But actually, I've really enjoyed sharing with him. Lovely man. He used to come here, actually, Canute, some of you might know him. And then he came back from a treat and he started reading Dante. It was an unlikely thing. I said, Dante, it's really good, isn't it? Said, yeah, I know it's really good. But you're the most unlikely person to read Dante. And then just on Saturday night, he came to poetry. He said, it's really good, it's really good. But it's not coming from an idea. Now I want to be an arty person. It's just coming from, we've been friends and we've talked about it a bit, and I discovered he was a really good proofreader, so I got him to proofread some poems. And I really love that one. It's very sort of natural. It's not a here's the sort of person I want to be kind of thing. So I'd really recommend that the value of the arts is it gives you innocent pleasure at best, just something that you just enjoy for its own sake. That's not crude, that's not to do with clinging, that's not to do with craving. You just enjoy it. Whilst I was on my Sartre retreat, I sort of agree about the time I read Wordsworth. I've never read Wordsworth. I've always been put off by him, actually. There's something about him I never quite liked to English. But I read them, and they're just wonderful, the best. It's fantastic. I just really enjoyed them. And I reread and reread them and just enjoyed them because they're just so lovely. It's like this lovely murmuring voice. It's like, it's really pleasant, you know, it's like being rocked. And when you finish it, reading it, you look around and everything looks a bit more worthy. And you know, suddenly you think, oh, they're lovely daffodils. So yeah, enjoyment of the art. Theatre, cinema, and all those sort of things. Mad Men, I've been enjoying. just to show that I'm not entirely highbrow. But also, I think, enjoyment of nature. Recently, a friend of mine went to see Bhante Sankaracharya, and he was saying, well, I need to really want to develop my imagination, what should I do? And he said, read poetry. I'm just going to read poetry. And then somebody else was saying, look, he was having a very difficult time, he went to see Bhante, and Bhante was saying, make sure you get out into nature a lot. You know, make sure you go for walks, spend time in nature, spend time doing nothing. Very interesting sometimes what he'll say, but I think this whole beneficial action is also to do with a real sense of the aliveness of nature. It's interesting, going back to Wordsworth, he felt that incredibly strongly, particularly when he was young. He had this almost supernatural sense of nature. He felt himself to be alive within this whole field of aliveness, so much so that sometimes he'd have to grab hold of a tree or touch a wall so to be clear that it was different from him. He felt so much that the life in him was exactly the same as the life outside of him, that sometimes he found it almost too much. In Prelude, he talks about rowing out, and you find the boat, a fisherman's boat in the lake. And he gets in the boat and he rows out into the lake at night with a lovely star shining. And as he rows out, the cliff, behind you can see the hill with the star above it. But of course, as he rows out, the cliff that's behind it rears up more and more and more. He's only a young boy at this time. He feels it to be like this huge, God, this huge sort of force actually, you know, following him across the lake, and he gets so kind of sort of frightened and touched by it. He has to row back and get off. It lasted for days, this sense of nature being animate and moving towards him. Yeah. And we've lost a lot of that sense. Many of us never had it, but often we had it a bit more when we were children. A sense of being alive, and that nature itself is alive. so that if you run into a tree, you kick the tree and say, "Naughty tree." I've forgotten more about that recently. I've talked to a friend of mine very seriously. And we walked out of the cafe, I said, "Hello, doggy." I said, "I ought to stop doing that." At the age of 50, I really ought to stop saying "hello, doggy." But that's sort of what you just immediately want to say, "Hello," because they're so benign, they're so stupidly benign. So I think part of this stage of skillful action is a much closer, much more direct sense of nature as being a living entity that we can relate to. And all of that, all of those practices, ethical practice, friendship, cultivating the arts, cultivating a very direct appreciation of nature, not a sort of standing back and enjoying it, but fully physicalized appreciation of nature. And I think comes along with that things like exercise and all that sort of thing. Feeling the nature in us. All of that, what it does, it lightens self. It brings air into the self. It makes self light so that something else can shine through it. But it's still self. It's a bit like a balloon. It starts off a little shrivelly pink thing, and you've blown it up and made it lighter and lighter and more buoyant. But it's still self. And it's still that balloon. And that actually has to go. For you to be completely in contact with other people in friendship and completely in contact with the natural world, in your walk, you need to actually get out of the balloon. You know, you need to see through self entirely. Even that very developed, very lit self, the balloon-like self, shot you with a light shining through it. Even that is still a kind of membrane around which we gather ourselves and separate ourselves in the same moment. And from the Buddhist point of view, it is just an idea. It's not actually there. It's just something that it's a story we tell ourselves, it's an idea. So spiritual death, the phase of spiritual death, is about seeing through that idea. About consciously renouncing yourself. And again, you see how you can't do that effectively unless you're really, really positive and really, really integrated. Otherwise, you'll try and do it prematurely. You'll try and do it out of a bright idea rather than a real necessity. It's getting mixed up with your own tendencies, perhaps even your own negative tendencies. So if you don't like yourself very much, you start thinking, well, that would be nice to get rid of the self, because I'm not very keen on myself. So it just becomes, it all gets embroidered with your own lack of self-esteem, if you see me. So you see to me that spiritual life can't develop in a balanced way, because you're getting pulled back by recalcitrant aspects of yourself which you haven't taken stock of in integration. So you can see why all these stages need to keep happening all the time. You don't leave integration behind. You keep on needing to learn something about that. Sometimes, you know, you've been practicing for quite a long time and you realise that there's much more work to do earlier on, and that you've had this uneven kind of growth. So you can see the importance of those stages. So you can't renounce self. You can't let go of the self in an unhealthy way, but nevertheless you do need to, otherwise spiritual life just becomes more and more of me, a more refined me. But even that refined you can sink back into something quite negative, sort of calcified snobbism, a kind of self-satisfaction. It's been quite interesting getting a little bit involved in the poetry world, because it is also a world riven by conflicts and by actually sometimes quite bad feeling. Because it's a world that's to do with reputation. There's no money in it, but there's a lot of reputation at stake. And any world that's based in reputation easily gets very flawed. But they're often very intelligent people doing very refined things. But if you're not careful, that falls back into a kind of refined egotism and sort of calcifies, if you're not careful. It's not enough in itself. It creates all kinds of dangers in itself. We do need to keep finding ways in which we renounce self. So, for instance, I was saying yesterday, it's those times in our life where we don't get what we want. Our partner leaves us, the job we wanted most falls through, the success we hoped for does we don't get, we suddenly get ill, or even just simply that you hold back from giving your opinion. Sometimes we're so keen to give our opinion, we don't actually find out what the other person is saying, and so on. So all those are that sort of little deaths of self. It's the times when you apologise, the times when you confess things, or you admit your own shortcomings. Any person genuinely spiritually practicing should be able to admit their own shortcomings. If they can't, then they don't know themselves really well. They haven't cultivated enough integration. And therefore their spiritual life is a bit wonky. So you should be able to admit your shortcomings in a very straightforward, non-indulgent kind of way. This is just something I'm not yet very good at, not very yet good, very persistent at. Spiritual death, it involves all those times where you just have to, where nothing else works, where self doesn't work, where self shows up that it doesn't work. Often when you don't get what you want. And one day we'll all not get what we want, which is to die. Literally to die. We absolutely won't want that. So we need to sort of practice not getting what we want. I really recently went on radio and it was all about success and failure. And it was about sport. I don't know what I was on talking about. I don't know if, as you can see, well, I think about sport. I think I was talking about mindfulness or something. And I was on with this personal trainer who trained people. And they were talking about failure and failure in sport and so on. And I just said eventually at the end, actually, I think failure is just a posh word for you not getting what you want. And shouldn't we just learn not to get what we want sometimes? And isn't that part of growing up? You can't always get what you want. You can call it failure if you want to, but actually all you did, you wanted the first prize and you didn't get it. Surprise! It's me! Hello! you don't always get what you want. I thought that's what your mother told you. So it's sort of things like that. So perhaps I'll draw it to a close just now and then see if there's any questions. So what I've done is I've recapitulated what I did last week. So we've got these five great stages that are both arranged hierarchically in terms of development, from integration to the positive emotion, to spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, to no more effort or compassionate activity. They're also arranged horizontally in terms of aspects that you need to have in your life all the time to have a balanced practice. So you need to be discovering yourself, you need to be exploring who kind of person you are, in integrating yourself, coming to terms with that, in a sense accepting that more and more. If you're an introvert, you're an introvert, you're not going to become an extrovert. I rather hope that by this time in my spiritual life, I'd be one of those very quiet kind of people, I'm never going to be, so it's not worth trying. It's mainly just for them. I wasn't quiet. Aware of myself. And then I need to be cultivating positive action, skillful action. I need to be enjoying nature. I need to be cultivating my imagination through the arts. I need to be giving, particularly to other people, giving my time, giving my effort, giving my cake. Not that I've met, but I can't remember the last time I baked a cake, but that's another. Then we need to start to realise that self does need to die, that it can never do it. It's an inbuilt problem in the whole thing, and that we need to renounce it, we need to see through it. And we need to practice that in little ways, apologising, confessing, not giving our opinion, not having to be in charge. What can happen sometimes when you end up teaching like me is you sort of feel like you have to be in charge. Recently I was leading a course, and Dharma Dinner, who's a very, very senior Dharmacharini at the Buddhist Center, she's a public preceptor, she came on my mindfulness course. I said, "What are you doing?" She said, "Well, I'm not very good at mindfulness." And I was really struck by that. I was very, very impressed by that. But there she is, she's been ordained much longer than me. She's coming on my mindfulness course because she wants to really cultivate mindfulness more deeply. I thought it showed a particular humility without trying to be humble, which I thought was really admirable, really, really admirable. So that is a sort of self-death, isn't it? You're not saying, "I'm a somebody, I'm a this, I'm a that." You're saying, "Actually, I do need to learn more about this, and I don't need to be proud about that." That's very well impressed, actually. So we need to practice dying in all those little ways, and then we need to cultivate spiritual rebirth. And I'll come on to that tomorrow. So are there any questions about that before we finish? Have I talked you into stunned silence?
Could you, I can't really even think how to phrase the question properly, but when you say I've got to die and the self is just an idea, What are we if we're not what we think we are?
Yes, indeed. In a certain sense, that is the great question. And one of the things that Buddhism is saying again and again is you're much more than you think you are. That there, everything you need is here. All the mysteries of the universe is here, in you, as it were. Sort of in you, or you, what you think you are includes those things, but you don't know it. Buddhism is always saying you're more than you think you are. What self is a little box that we try and put the universe in, which is even Buddhist. It's like trying to put a balloon into a cardboard box, and you push one bit and another bit sticks out, and you put that in it. In a certain sense, you can't say what we are. We're this constantly changing pattern. It is a bit mysterious because it's not that you're nothing, because everything that you've been shapes you. Even the Buddha is quite obviously a very particular kind of person. He's even supposed to be a wisdom Buddha, and the next Buddha is supposed to be a kindness Buddha. And that's a very crude way of talking about him. But presumably it's saying he's a particular kind of Buddha. On the basis of all the things that he was that led up to Buddhahood. So Bhante says somewhere it's not the structure of your mind that changes, but the contents. So it's not that you become unrecognizable, but the image is often like you're cleaning a jewel, you're cleaning a stained glass window. It's the same pattern, but this light shines through it. Which is the light of reality, but it shines through the particular shape that life has made you. All your actions have made you. Every time we act, every time we think, every time we feel something, every time we do something, we're creating ourselves all the time. We're always a work in progress. Buddhism says that we're never fixed, but this idea of fixed self, that somehow underneath all the things that happens to me is a me that doesn't change. It's just an idea. What we are is this constantly changing pattern and structure. And the content of that structure can be more or less profound. And it's all there for us, if you mean. But we're so addicted almost to me, what I like, what I don't like, who I am, who I'm not.
That's the thing with knowing who you are, is we are constantly changing.
Yes.
Consciousness or what have you, how we to know what is fixed about ourselves.
That's right.
Characteristic.
Yes, it's a question I've had myself for a long time.
I'd like to think that we can always improve and we can change it.
We can, yeah. But we can't change. Some things are easier to change than others.
Yeah.
But also some things we don't need to change. So I think sometimes it's quite handy to think, okay, what are the things about myself I don't want to change? So, you know, for instance, I don't particularly want to change my sense of humour. And it could get better. But I actually like it now. I had a stage where I thought I shouldn't have a sense of humour because people won't take me seriously. My sense of humour was much more about entertaining people so that they loved me because I felt insecure. Yeah? It's now generally not about that. I just quite like a laugh. And I think it's an important part of being together is we can have a laugh together. It's not no longer using me if this is me. But I don't want it not to be there. I want to be able to be serious if I need to be, but not serious if I don't, if this is me. So I'm not going to be someone who's very serious and earnest. It doesn't suit me when I try and do it. I can do it, and sometimes it's needed. I've been very, very serious when I did it here this week, but not if it's not needed. This is what you said to me. I'm not going to be a very quiet person who's very... I'm just not, you know. So if I try and change those things, or think they should change, I'm just going to get myself into trouble. Some people think they should be very much more extroverted than they are. And it's just not a useful place to put your energy. You see what I mean? But the thing is, it needs to always be provisional, because I think what your question also reveals to me is that if you're not careful, all these things become infinite. So how integrated do you need to be? I don't know, that for me is a bit of a question. Because it's endless, isn't it? You could be discovering yourself the rest of time, tinkering with yourself. When you sometimes I think self-awareness and getting to know yourself is a bit like tinkering with a car on the drive. But when are you actually going to get in it and drive off? You know, and think, okay, it's kind of fine now. You could just tinker with it forever. Sorry? Yeah, like painting the Fort Bridge, just to go on it forever. So how integrated do you actually need to be? I think where you need to look is when it goes wrong. When spiritual life goes wrong. What is there to learn from that? Learn from the bum notes of the day, if it is me. But even with that, I think it needs to be slightly provisional, because you can't ever find out who you are. The wires of intention go off into the dark. You don't really know what motivates you, right? I think this is one of the spooky things about being human, is we don't really know what motivates us. We've got ideas about it, we've got stories about it, but we don't really know what motivates us. We find ourselves at the Buddhist Center, and we find something that's important. We don't know why we've come quite. We've got stories about why we have, but we don't really know. I slightly wonder whether we know just before we die, whether you really know in that moment. You know, they say your life flashes before you. I wonder whether what happens then is you see what you've really been doing. Oh, I've just been trying to get loved. Or, oh, I've been mainly, I don't know, just a little bit proud of myself. Or you find, actually, no, I have mainly been wanting to grow and learn. And probably the answer is much better than we expect. But we probably never quite know, usually, what we're really being motivated by. We're strange in that way, aren't we? As I say, the wires of motivation go off into the dark. I particularly experienced this once because I nearly went back to art school. I applied to go back to art school to do my MA. And I had a really, really good reason why I wanted to do that. And I thought it was important for me. This is fairly recently, in the last 10 years. And then I didn't get in. They probably laughed. Oh, person. I didn't get in. And I had really, really good reasons why it was good not to get in. And you think, hang on. You know, all this is post hoc rationalisation. I don't really know what was motivating me. I now believe in my good reasons not to get in. But I would do, because I didn't get in. Yeah, so I think the question is, how integrated do you need to be? And I don't know the answer. At least not yet. But certainly, if we try to change things that we don't need to change, will cause us our suffering. If we don't get to know ourselves enough to know that actually, no, I need to be making sure I've got enough time on my own if I'm an introvert, or need to be making sure that I'm having enough positive pleasures that are innocent pleasures, we're going to get ourselves into trouble. And unnecessarily, isn't it? But I can't actually pin the question down. I think what you were saying there is very trenchant.
I'm sort of confused by using words like introvert and extrovert, because to me they're kind of flying in the face of the idea that all things change. From a Western culture which is dogmatic and
I kind of agree, but then I see people who are, you know, I recently, before I shared with Knud, who's as extrovert as she could possibly be, I used to share with Manusia, who's very, very introverted. And I think if I didn't take that into account, we'd get into problems. So for instance, I'm an extrovert, so I think out loud. I do that naturally and instinctively. So when I was sharing with her, I used to come into a room and say to her, what was I thinking? I don't know. And I don't mean it as a question. I mean, I just speak out, think out loud on that. What do I think? What am I doing? Oh, you're telling me. I'll do things like that, you know. He would never do that. And if he says something, he'd say something and he'd have thought about it a lot. And if he's not careful, if I say something, he thinks that I would have thought about it a lot. But I haven't. I've just thought about it just in this very second. You know what I mean? So we can get into all sorts of problems. But you said this, and I said, yeah, no, but I didn't. I was just saying that, you know what I mean? Whereas for him saying that is really, he's thought about it a lot. So I think things like extroversion and introversion, they're not religions, but they're getting at something. We need to get to know ourselves in some way, and all of these Western patterns are attempts to do that. You may or may not be attracted to them, but we need to get to know who the kind of creature we are, or we will get into trouble, not only with ourselves, but with each other. I remember a particular friend of mine said he emailed this friend of his, and there were two questions in my email and he didn't answer either of them. I said, well, I'm not surprised, because your friend is a hugely extrovert, you're an introvert. He gets your questions, he thinks, yeah, great questions, yeah, I've got questions. Oh, questions, well, never occurs to me to think, actually, they're supposed to be answers. Said, yeah, when shall we meet? Where shall we go? We go here, we go there. Yeah, great, good on you. No, when shall we meet? I thought it was a classic misunderstanding. So you have to actually say, could you answer these questions? Oh yeah, no, we then. Just mean, but otherwise you think, oh yeah, it's a good question, great question. I've got questions. Anyway, perhaps we should finish there.